You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Well, hello there, Anne. Nice to see you again at the UA conference.
Always a pleasure to see you, Martin, and especially in person.
Well, that's right. We spend a lot of time talking with each other remotely on Zoom and all the rest of it, but we first met in London, where you ran a workshop on disruption and change in higher education about 2 years ago. Remember that?
Yeah, I do. I think there's always room for a good conversation about potential disruptions. And you know, you see a lot of that in the Accord report as well. You know, there are some really interesting threads about technology disruptions, changing market, changing expectations, obviously the skills agenda and labour markets. And from my point of view, always a good thing to discuss.
Well, I think so. And look, we've been having that discussion now for 3 years. I'm delighted that the new book that you've helped me so ably and skillfully pull together of contributions over the last year and a half or so has been able to get launched here at the UA conference just 2 days after the Accords report came out. I'd like to think of them as complimentary and the messages they've got to say about different things, but I've been then fascinated to take this as a chance to interview so many vice chancellors, deputy vice chancellors and others about what they think of the Accord and the report. But you're doing that too. You're not interviewing them, but you're talking with them, and I'm sure you've got your own views. Why don't you start us off by telling us what you think about the Accords, viewing it from your perspective?
I don't know if you remember, but when the interim report came out, it's 170 pages, and I said it was my happy place wading through the document. So obviously I'm at least two and a bit times more excited about a 400-page report. There's a lot in there. I think it's fascinating. I think what we need to remember is a couple of things. The first is, it's only half an artifact, right? We need the government's response, because clearly these reports are negotiated with government. There's a lot of backroom deals that go on, and I'm sure the recommendations will be accepted. But what really matters is what there's money behind. So we're actually looking ahead to the budget, but also to the changes that happen within the department and what the minister says about what he can achieve in the short term. So that's one starting point. I think got really kind of two views on the report. On the one hand, you know, I think it's amazing. I think it's exciting. I think it potentially changes the narrative about the position of higher education in Australia now and into the future. And that is a material change that people should be really delighted about. And that's, if that's the top-down view, I've then got a bottom-up view, which is, I take issue with some of the recommendations and some of the data and so on, but I'm a policy wonk at heart, and I'm interested in the detail there, and I'm unconvinced that it hangs together as a coherent reform package.
Yeah, I think some of the observations that I made myself and HeadX made as part of its submission to the interim report were challenges around the funding and affordability of some of this, and the lack of an overall framework, as well as drawing attention to some of the things that were missing in terms of a focus on technology, a focus on new models, a focus on innovation. And like you, whilst being a hugely supportive, being hugely supportive of its overall vision and positioning, I think it is fair to say that there are some things that would be well fleshed out and well thought through in the processes ahead. But look, let's get into the conference and hear from a range of vice chancellors and those attending with us here over this next couple of days of what they think about the Accord final report.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
Professor Debbie Terry of the University of Queensland, Vice Chancellor. Lovely to see you here at the UA conference. How are you enjoying yourself?
Very much, as always. Nice to see you, Martin, and congratulations on the new book. I'm very much looking forward to reading it.
Oh, thank you. It was lovely to share it with you and to have such great contributions to it from some real great people at UQ and Paul Harper and Jack Wang, who contributed sections and chapters.
Absolutely. Two superstars, obviously, among many.
Yes, amongst many indeed. And look, I'm delighted with your news about your renewal and extension of your position at UQ. I'm sure that's a relief for you to have that out in the public domain.
Absolute privilege, obviously, to be in my role, and I really look forward to continuing to be there. It's an absolute privilege.
I'm sure it is. I was at your campus at St Lucia just a couple of weeks ago at seeing lots of people at orientation, pre-orientation activities. It really did look a gem and a jewel of a place to be right now.
We're very fortunate, but obviously always need to stay focused on what else we need to do to ensure that the university continues to deliver way into the future.
Well, look, way into the future has been a bit of a theme of the discussions around here for the last couple of days. You know, a release of a Cord final report on Sunday morning to keep us all busy over the weekend.
Absolutely.
Lots of VC plenary activities yesterday, and then Mary joining us on stage at the conference this morning to tell us the story behind the story, as it were. What's your sense with all the conversations that you've been part of as Vice Chancellor of, you know, a great university, a great Australian university, and as a former chair of UA, what does this bit of policy development mean for you personally, for UQ and for our sector?
Well, I think what is so impressive, Martin, is that it is bold, it is ambitious, and it really does take that long-range view of what does the sector need to deliver by 2050. It's data-informed, it's evidence-based, and I think I really commend the panel not only for being able to articulate that vision, but being able then to identify what needs to happen to ensure that we realise that vision. And that's not easy to do. You know, often people will get the vision right or they'll be focused on the details, but to do both simultaneously, I commend Mary O'Kane and obviously the whole panel.
I can remember that being a theme. I'm sure you'll remember this only too well. When we had a conversation on the HeadX podcast a year or so ago, you just released your strategy looking 10 years into the
Absolutely.
Future.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
And you were saying that the opportunity of a Brisbane Olympics Games and Paralympics Games 10 years out gave you a really good lighthouse on the hill almost. But you were really focused on what needed to happen in that immediate 12 months too. So what will happen in UQ with all the good work that you've been doing? Now we have this Accord report out. You've got a strategy for 8 more years left into the future towards the Games. You've got a blueprint for the sector for 25 years. And I'm sure you've got some short-term priorities. With your own extended term of office, how are you going to keep those different timescales mutually in focus and keep the trajectory of success that you've achieved at UQ?
It's a very good question, Martin. Obviously, we'll remain very much focused on that 10-year horizon for the University of Queensland. But I think what this Accord does is that it really does articulate what we need to be look like into the future. But it really takes up, obviously, as a centrepiece, delivering skills through equity, which is a great centrepiece. It's really important that, you know, those parts of our community that are currently underrepresented in higher education and in tertiary education, we absolutely need to address that. We need to ensure that our funding model for both education and research is fit for purpose. And that is what comes through the report. It's not only what we deliver in education and what we deliver in skills that is so critical, it's what we deliver in terms of research and innovation that is also so critical. So the fact that we saw through the report detailed recommendations for how we better support students to study, we better support the cost of study, that we broaden our pathways into university, we're very clear what our targets are, but that the funding model for both education and research needs to be simplified, it needs to be fit for purpose to ensure, as Mary said this morning, that Australia plays the role that it needs to do as a leading nation in this part of the world.
Well, that's a very good summary of the issues and the importance of them, Debbie. And look, we look forward to engaging with lots of your colleagues at our 21st of March HeadX conference
Absolutely.
In Melbourne.
Yeah, I'm sorry I won't be there, but I'll...
Well, we've got lots of your senior colleagues coming, and we're delighted about that. And look, we look forward to connecting with you later in the year, maybe in Brisbane, around keeping that conversation going on a national
Absolutely.
Level, based at one of such a leading university of our own in Brisbane and in Queensland.
Absolutely.
Advocating for Australia. Yeah.
No, no, thank you, Martin, and thank you for all that you do to obviously, you know, ensure that the major issues affecting the sector are well and truly on the agenda through all of the different things that you offer and support. So thank you.
Great to be joined by Luke Chi of Universities Australia. What did you say, 3 weeks into the CEO role?
Yeah, this is the last day of the third week, so, you know, not much happening.
You do choose your moments, Luke, don't you?
Well, you know, I mean, I could have waited until after all the Accord and the summit had been over, but it was good to get in, get started with the team. And what a week. Right?
Well, what a week indeed, and what a period for higher education in Australia. You must be beside yourself with excitement once you get over the thrill.
Well, as a self-described policy nerd, this is kind of the time to really kind of stretch your policy nerd legs or wings, so to speak. You know, I've been involved with this Accord process through my previous job at ATM and the Ministerial Reference Group. You know, it feels like years, but really, since Minister Clare announced at the Bradley Oration the terms of reference back in November 22, you know, it's been hours of work for lots of people in the sector, including me, including, you know, vice chancellors and policy directors and policy agitators.
It's great, isn't it?
It's great.
It's great. And look, Universities Australia is really the place to be now, isn't it? We're all here because it's where all the action is. We're delighted that your chair, David Lloyd, is joining us on stage in Melbourne on March the 21st. So we hope give a bit more of a considered and reflective view developed across Universities Australia by then,
yep,
of what we think of the Accords, what we think of government's reaction, what we think of the way that people have engaged with it. But here we are, just so raw, 2 days old.
Yeah.
What is your view as a brand new shiny CEO of Universities Australia about the way that the sector's engaged with a set of ideas and what you think UA thinks of those ideas?
Well, I think universally, everyone has acknowledged the significant amount of work that's gone into this Accord process. And we had a discussion paper, an interim report, and now this final report. And there has been significant movement, progress, refinement, and thought put into it. And as Mary O'Kane said to us all this morning, it's a cogent system redesign process. And I believe everyone's acknowledged that across the sector. And rightly, we haven't rushed to pick it apart. We haven't rushed to pick a winner. We are looking at it line by line and working out what the implications are. Of course, contingent to this is the government's response. And what we would hope initially is that we get a Accord implementation advisory group up and running very quickly, because the flagship suggestion is a tertiary education commission in order to redesign the funding and regulatory systems for both teaching and learning and research. And regulation, for that matter. We've got to design the Tertiary Education Commission, so we've got to get on with the job. So for us, that's our first priority. So rightly so, that's what we're focused on in the first few days. And then again, how ambitious is it to double the number of people in university education over the coming decades, and particularly from people from disadvantaged backgrounds? It is a bold idea to open the doors of universities and, more broadly, tertiary education to as many Australians as possible. And with that 80% attainment target, to me that says we are inching towards, well, not inching, frankly, we are now working towards universality of post-secondary education for all working-age people in Australia. And for me, that's been a long-held policy ambition as a policy nerd, and I'm delighted to see that.
Well, one thing that's just occurred to me to ask you is that with Accord trying to take us towards a more joined up university and tertiary education, with vocational education included, therefore, system, here we are at Universities Australia's conference, organised by Universities Australia. I don't know what the infrastructure is on the vocational education side and the extent to which you work with them, and you might work more closely with them on the future.
Yeah.
In leading your shared members in that journey that we need to take together. Can you comment?
Well, of course, we have, you know, 4 or 5 dual sector universities already within the Universities of Australia. And, you know, I've come from, my office used to be at RMIT, so I know dual sector universities well. I worked at Swinburne. I love dual sector universities, but they're not all of the sector. Jenny Dodds just come off stage here as CEO of TAFE Directors Australia. And Jenny played a pivotal role, not only in the Ministerial Reference Group, but played a pivotal role in Universities Australia's working group about the Accord, where he brought university groupings and TAFE directors and business and Chancellor representatives all together. And that level of cooperation is, I think, what we're going to have to do more and more of moving forward, particularly in the Accord context.
And look, I was delighted to be a guest at the VC's dinner last night, and I'm sure there are some things there that need to stay in camera, but there were a lot of things that were very much for public digestion as well, I'm sure. And the overriding message in some of the VCs being farewelled was the call for members of UA to speak with one voice and stick together on this. Yeah. I'm sure you must be feeling the responsibility of leading that more than anyone else in the nation. Yeah. How's it going?
Yeah. Well, I'm 3 weeks in, so don't judge me yet. I'm still swatting for the exam. No, I think it does help in the political system in Australia that peak bodies representing universities, representing business, representing other types of civic and business groups do have a common purpose, right? And there's so much in this Accord report which we already, through our previous submissions, either agree to or agree in principle, and that's a good thing. So, you know, when you're dealing with ministers and you're dealing with departments, you're dealing with state governments or territory governments, it's important that there is a pretty a voice of authority on behalf of universities, and that's why I'm really excited to be in this role right now, because increasingly this is looking like a development of a truly national system for tertiary education, and the role of public universities within that is terribly important. So Universities Australia role, I believe, is going to be amplified.
Well, I'm sure you're right. 3 weeks in must be very exciting. Whether you'll still be the CEO in 25 years' time, Luke, I don't know.
Probably... I'll be terribly old, and I will literally have no hair left. I barely have any already. So
there's not a great advantage in hair in my experience. But I wish you well in you're keeping your hair and you're keeping your sense of humour and you're keeping your focus on the exciting times in front of us. Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us, Luke Chu.
Great to chat. Thanks.
Professor Renee Leon, the Vice-Chancellor of Charles Sturt University. Lovely to see you again here at the UA Conference.
It's always great to be here.
And Renee, it's not always the case that we're at a UA Conference where such a landmark bit of policy advice and thought is brought to a head and released to the sector in the way that it has over the last few days here. I'm sure you've got a lot of reactions to the whole process to that and some thoughts about the highlights that you see in this University's Accord final report. Would you share them with us?
Yes, so obviously in terms of the process, it's great that it's been very consultative across the sector and that it's taken account of a lot of evidence, including evidence that the panel commissioned to consider the issues before it. In terms of the highlights in the report, we really welcome the focus on regional universities and the recognition that they are doing the heavy lifting on the equity students that the report recognises must participate and attain more. And I like the fact that, of course, that equity is such a focus of the Accord, the recognition that not only is it deeply unfair that students from poorer backgrounds and from regional areas aren't getting the same access to the opportunities of higher education, but also that Australia's productivity depends on that access being equalised. So really like both of those focuses. And the third thing that I'm welcoming about the Accord is that it's taken a careful approach to balancing the benefits of the free market approach to higher education with the needs for a more planned approach so that universities and regions are sustainable.
You sound like you're a bit of a fan of the report. Is there anything not to like about it?
Well, the proof will be in what gets implemented, really. The Minister's already said in a hint to the fact that we shouldn't expect it all to be implemented quickly, that it's a multi-decade implementation program. I suppose I would like to see, either have seen from the panel or pretty quickly see from the government, some indication of the prioritisation and the staging of those reforms. Some of the reforms obviously have been recommended time and time again and never been implemented. So are we going to see a roadmap soon for what will be implemented and when?
Well, one thing that I know you and I have touched upon in the past, and it's you haven't mentioned it as either a highlight or a negative, but there's a relatively understated reference there to a national, regional university in the report, and it refers to the need for some further thinking about that, not either coming out in favour of it or dismissing it. Where do you think we're up to in the discussion that we need to have about that concept?
Well, that is what I think we need to do, is some proper thinking about it, because as a concept, it's impossible to say whether it's a good or a bad thing until some more thinking has been done and more development of the concept has been done to identify, such as, what is the problem we're trying to solve? If it is financial sustainability of universities, then what are the costs that would be taken out or the revenue that would be increased if you were to have a national regional university? Or if it's to give greater status and standing and attractiveness to study at a regional university, then we need to do some market testing of whether, in fact, the concept of a national regional university would deliver that additional status and standing. Or if it's to aggregate and share research infrastructure, then we need to map what is the existing research infrastructure, and would bringing it together in one institution have the benefits that are expected to be achieved. So for me, that's always been the case about the National Regional University, is that we should identify what's the problem we think it would solve, and then test with a decent bit of thinking and evidence whether it would solve those problems.
Sounds like you got that pretty well thought out, I have to say. And look, just in coming to a close then, Renee, report that's been out of 16 months or whatever it has been of work, I don't know what the next 16 months looks like. Presumably from what you've said, you're not going to go back and change the CSU strategy tomorrow, but by the same token, you can't fail to pay attention to this report. What does the next 12 months say that CSU look like in response to this report?
So the report is very much aligned with Charles Sturt's existing mission and strategy, in that our focus is on educating for the regions and educating students that should get the opportunity for a higher education, but at the moment, in many cases, are not. So we will be continuing to demonstrate to the government how important it is that regional universities are supported to do what we do, and how ensuring that the way they respond to these reforms doesn't either intentionally or inadvertently actually damage the sustainability and the business model of the regional universities. I think we also need to be having some really strong input into whatever thinking goes on towards the establishment of the Tertiary Education Commission, to make sure that it's set up to do the evidence-based policy and system design and management that will ensure the right level of planning within a currently free market approach to higher education, so that we get not just individual universities succeed, but that Australia succeeds, that the nation as a whole succeeds in building both opportunity and productivity.
Fabulous. Well, there's some very well thought through and well articulated views, Renee. Thanks very much for joining
us
on the HEDX podcast.
And I'll look forward to talking to you when we get the government's response to the report.
I'll come back to you then, and we'll have a longer conversation really what this does mean for regional universities. I think that would be a hugely interesting conversation to follow up.
Looking forward to it, Martin.
So, Chris Moran, the Vice Chancellor of University of New England. Nice to see you here at the UA conference. How are you going?
I'm very well, thanks, Martin. How are you?
I'm very well too. And like all of us, probably still trying to make sense of and absorbing and beginning the process of reflecting on that landmark document that landed on all of our inboxes, if not desks, on Sunday morning, in terms of a 25-year vision for Australian higher education. The University Accord, what do you make of it in terms of what are you seeing as its overall vision and its alignment with your own vision, and any sense of the highlights in this report from your point of view?
I think of it a bit like a paleontologist, except instead of finding the backbone of the dinosaur, the paleontologist has found a finger, a piece of brain, a piece of bone, and the question is, what does the animal look like? And I think that's the challenge for all of us. It's such a comprehensive document, and it has so many what I would call gifts in it. And therefore, as I'm sure everyone's saying, the implementation issue is the number one For University of New England, the issue, the greatest issue here is the access and social justice issue. We're a stretched university because of our cohort. I think us and James Cook University stand out in the nation with rural and regional, indigenous and low SES students. And we struggle with the part-time nature of that and the cost of that and the cost of the pathway program. So they're the two big things that are sitting there for UNE right now. So we have needs-based funding that's a sensible approach and Commonwealth-supported places that are fee-free for students to come into university. It doesn't have to be our university. That's transformational for our region. The rest of it, you know, there's a lot that would be interesting to see as a Vice-Chancellor, as a member of the Academic Community of Australia, but those two things are really the things for UNE that can make a great difference.
Very good. And look, you're very much a regional and equity-focused university and have long history of achievements of having succeeded in that space. I was talking to Alex Olinsky a little bit earlier from University of Newcastle, a fellow Vice-Chancellor from New South Wales, who maybe has a similar perspective for you. And he was at great points to say that it was an important point in time for the sector to stick together with an overall vision, even though there might be some individual things that he and each of you might take exception to and maybe not agree with. I mean, without labouring that then, there's probably some things that you are disappointed to see in there, are not so happy about. And if so, what are they? And how are you going to put them behind you as you sign up to the bigger picture and the advantages?
It's not so much that, Martin. For me, there's not any kind of big bears in there or irritations in there. I think that challenge coming to your reference to Alex's coherence question, and I think all the Vice-Chancellors are having the same, particularly the HEF, I think. That's the sort of standout issue that certain universities are obviously earning far more income than others. From my perspective, there's a privilege component to that. If I could be the University of New England, Armidale, on Sydney Harbour, then I'd gratefully accept the fact that a lot of people around the world would love to come and study at my harbour and my beaches. So there is a privilege component of that, and that creates a tension in the system of those who feel as though they would be unreasonably required to pay on the basis of success rather than some other approach of raising the funds. And obviously there's a little bit of division and some challenges, I think, coming to a coherent view. The other one is the TEC itself. It sort of appeared very early in the discussions, I think, around the accord that we needed an independent entity. And I think as more conversations proceed, the questions of, well, who might head that up? How might it choose what to do? What would be the order of things that it would take on? And what does that mean with respect to the way that governments of the future may view that independent body? I think those are probably some tension points that have to get worked through. Now, ultimately, that'll be a matter for the Senate as much as anyone else, right, as to whether such a body would get created, whether it would absorb the Australian Research Council and the regulator. There's quite a lot of points of potential difference and tension in there. But I don't see anything that jumps out at me as kind of missing. In some sense, that might be the overall critique of the accord. Mm. There's almost nothing missing on offer. Mm. And therefore, how a government might navigate what order it might go through and how it might deal with the resourcing issues that are inherent. That's a real challenge. I mean, Mary O'Kane was at pains this morning to point out that compared to other investments in the economy, the total investment, whilst uncosted in detail, she's probably got an approximation of that and feels that it's in line with the economy of the future of Australia. So perhaps we should be optimistic on that front. Hard to say. You're a commentator on the the sector as much as anyone, so you probably have a good helicopter view on that.
Well, I mean, I think the sort of the money line for her this morning was when asked of can we afford to do this, saying can we afford not to do this, I thought was a really way of turning that question around. And I'm really encouraged in the little interviews I'm doing here with you and with others in this couple of days, and the general conversation around the piece, how little contention there seems to be around either the overall vision or so much of the detail. But maybe turning that back to you as that observation as a commentator, I wonder how much difference at this stage of its definition and its implementation planning this is going to make to you when you get back to Armidale or someone else getting back to Sydney Harbour in what you're going to do next month, 3, 6, 12 months time.
I can give you a concrete
example. Will it change things directly?
Yeah, I can give you a concrete example. So we're committed to extending our activities in Tamworth. Our university's been working in Tamworth since actually before 1938 when we were created. People were active there in adult education and building capability in the community of Tamworth. So we've always been there. But we've now got a commitment to build a more formal campus for Tamworth. Tamworth's a city of 80, 90,000 people with only 15% bachelor's education. And the community are asking the university to engage to lift for the future skills, exactly that story. Right now, we need to resource that ourselves as a university. And when I mean resource it, resource the pipeline issue, resource the growing awareness, turning the attention of young people in that community towards university. Not even necessarily our university, but towards university. I've already contacted my university and said, that other cohort of people, the people who have left school over the last 5 to 10 years, they probably now take equal precedence for us than the school leavers who are coming in the next 2 years, because in any reasonable probability that the government would implement something like the preparatory courses, we can change what we're doing and we can have a really direct positive impact on a specific important community. So yes, we will do that differently. In fact, I've signalled to my university for people to start drafting up a bit of a change of direction. I have a letter drafted from previous work to the General Manager of the Council of Tamworth, and I've asked for that letter to be held back because I actually think we should signal that we think the Accord is potentially going to change the ability we have to move with the community of Tamworth.
That's a fabulous example, Chris. So this is a bit of policy document that's not only impacting where we might all be thinking for 25 years into the future, but it's changing letters that you're in the process of writing about Tamworth tomorrow.
So I'm quite excited about that. I really am.
I'm sure Mary O'Kane would be encouraged to hear that. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners to our
podcast.
Well,
she came to listen.
Yeah.
This panel has listened. They've engaged tremendously well. She's a very good discussant. She's not passive, but she's not dominating. I think that the way they went through the process was great. They came and had a session on regional in Armidale. I wasn't the VC at the time, so I missed out on that. But they left a very good impression behind them of having listened to community and listened to the regional universities. And you can see it in that chapter in the report. They've diagnosed Australia's regional education, tertiary education problems very well.
Chapter 7, isn't it?
Chapter 7. If there's only one chapter you're reading,
you're the advocate of Chapter 7.
I am Chris. Mr. Chapter
I've 7. Seen that in social media already. Everybody get as far in as Chapter 7.
Just start at Chapter 7. Start at Chapter 7. Oh, Chapter 1, because you get a bit of background and then you jump straight to Chapter 7.
Well, thank you for saving us all a lot of time.
Chapter 3, I'll tell you what though, Chapter 3 document. Also has, for anyone listening, there are some really important simple graphics in Chapter 3 on the cumulative effect of disadvantage. So if you are low socioeconomic status and Indigenous and a disability, 30% chance of falling out of university if you get in. So we're focused a lot here on access. Our university spends a lot of time on trying to retain those students because we have a government and successive governments who focus on attrition, which is fine if you've got the best school leavers in the state pouring out of private schools into the University of Sydney. But the cohort of people that we bring into the University of New England, my view is we should be counting how many succeed.
Yes. Flipping it again and
absolutely
putting
it
positive.
Not that I'm happy to lose any of them, but remember these were in the main, none of them were going to university until we prepared them and enabled them and made them feel as though this was a possibility. So there's a lot of flipping to be done here, I think.
Well, thank you for flipping the conversation for us, and thank you for flipping where people should start their reading of the Accord if they haven't finished it yet.
It was a flipping pleasure, Mark.
For being such a great guest with us on the HeadX podcast, Chris Moran from University of New England, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Okay, Claire Pollock from Western Sydney University, Provost and Senior Deputy Vice-Chancellor. Lovely for you to join us here at the UA conference. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thanks, Arnie. It's great to be here. Really exciting time.
Isn't it exciting time for the sector? That report on a Sunday morning has really set the cat amongst the pigeons, isn't it? Tell me what you think about it personally and what if it's not the same, what Western Sydney University think about it in terms of highlights for you and anything that disappoints you?
I think the for me and for Western Sydney, it's big and it's bold and it's future focused. I love it. Not surprising. I think it's a fabulous report. Of course, we had the Vice Chancellor at Western Sydney University, Barney Glover, on the panel, so I'm not surprised. It's great. I think my favourite part, I love the first recommendation around the statement of the objective of higher education, tertiary education for Australia. And I think it's really important that there's that recasting of what's the tertiary education sector about, the higher education sector about. And it's about protecting democracy, and it's about having a productive and safe and harmonious society. I mean, what's better than that? That's why we're in this job that we do. So I think that is brilliant. I think there's nothing that I'm disappointed at. I think the challenge is to make sure that we don't get tied up with worrying about nuanced detail and take on board that big picture. We've got to commit, the government has to commit, and the sector has to commit, industry has to commit, to say we've got to get change, we've got to get progress, and get started and get it acting action very quickly.
Well, there's some very sharp pointed words around what the priorities are short term, but a focus on the horizon in terms
Absolutely.
Of where it's all taking us. Lovely for you to share those thoughts with us, Claire. You shared a lot of thoughts when we had the interim report out last July, and the day after it happened.
Yes.
And I know we captured a lot of those in a podcast at the time, and they also featured as a transcribed interview and an opinion piece that we put in the new book that you're holding.
I am.
On changing higher education for good.
It's a great read. Not obviously apart from the transcript that I was part of, but the rest of it I'm sure is brilliant.
It's 100 pages shorter than The University is the Cause. I just draw that to everyone's attention.
Well, in that case, it's a 10-minute skim read than a 15-minute skim read. I doubt there would be the kind of level of complexity in this that we've got in the Accord. Coming back to the Accord final review, I think the vision that it places around a productive society is fantastic, and it's really striking. I listened to Mary O'Kane speak this morning at the UA conference, and that dual emphasis on equity for skills and about discovery. And you know, at our heart as a higher education sector, it's about discovery and application, and it's about education. Having that skills focus, I think, is really lovely, and the integration across a fully integrated tertiary education sector, that will be groundbreaking for Australia.
I have to say, I don't think your tone and your message has changed since July the 21st last year, and nor would I have expected it to. And it's lovely to see some consistency, some clarity, and some real focus and purpose in message from one of Australia's leaders. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Martin. Very welcome.
Simon Biggs, the Vice-Chancellor of James Cook University. Great to see a fellow Queenslander down here at Canberra, Simon. How are you going?
I'm good, Martin. Thank you.
And look, we're here to hear in the nation's capital about what the nation's agenda for higher education is for the next 25 years. You'll have read the Accord on Sunday morning like the rest of the sector. You've been there with the Vice-Chancellors the last 24 hours and hearing Mary O'Kane in her own voice this morning. What are your highlights from you personally and for James Cook University and what you see in the Accord, and what are you most hopeful for from it?
Well, I think the pervasive thread in the Accord is all about equitable access to higher education and addressing those those markets that have been difficult for higher education to penetrate. Indigenous students, remote rural students, and those are really, those are the central reasons for the existence of a university like JCU. So I've got to say, for us, I think actually if the recommendations can be enacted, there's a lot in there that gives me a lot of hope as a regional provider of higher education.
But there's been different people commenting on which words occur most in the Accords, and equity gets a lot of mentions. Integrity perhaps was
identified as not so many, and I know technology is perhaps a little bit underdeveloped. The word regional, has very special connotations in Australia, doesn't it? We don't use it so much in a British or a US context. What do you think this accord is going to do for regions, for regional Australia and for regional universities that has been long overdue?
Yeah, and I think, you know, like, you can still, there's still arguments about what is truly regional. Take our university, closest capital city is Port Moresby. We're Townsville, you know, we're 1,700 kilometres from Brisbane. Cairns, we're 2,100 kilometres from Brisbane. There's no, absolutely no shadow of a doubt that we're a regional provider. And, you know, if you look at the size of the catchment area that JCU services, it's just immense, with not many people in it. But I was out in Mount Isa last week, you know, a city of 20,000 people. How do people there get access to good quality higher education? And how do they get some options to have face-to-face support and tuition without relocating to a capital city or without even relocating to Townsville and Cairns, which before they've even paid their fees is going to cost them $30,000 a year?
Crazy. I didn't really expect in a HeadEx podcast I'd ever be standing in camera talking about Mount Isa, but I think it's so important that the whole nation has this perspective on issues that affect real regions and some of those ambiguous areas of whether they're regional or not. And look, there's a bit of a sleeper in there about, and I haven't heard much comment on it, around the concept of a national regional university. I know this was something that Bradley first put forward. There are a few investigations in it since. I think the accord suggests that we should have over the next couple of years a bit more of an evaluation of it. I'm sure you have views on it. I'm sure JCU has views on it. I'm sure other regional universities have views on it. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I know for a fact the spectrum of views amongst my regional university colleagues is, as you would expect, from flat out no through to let's have a deeper think about it. I think at JCU we're on the end of let's have a deeper think about it. The reason being, I think if you, for example, you know, the oft-touted University of California system, right? There are, 7-8 universities in the University of California system, and each of those campuses have quite separate missions and quite high degrees of autonomy to pursue those missions. I mean, there's a lot of difference between UC Berkeley and UC Riverside, right? There's a difference in what the university, yeah, so there's a difference in how they service their communities, and that autonomy flows through. So could you set up a regional Australian national regional university and retain vital, you know, local autonomy? I think the answer has to be yes. How it might play through would be interesting to see, but you know, ultimately, what's it all about? It's if it unlocks stronger, more secure, more sustainable, long-term basis of funding regional education in Australia, I think we have to look at that seriously. That's a personal view. Won't be shared by all my colleagues, I'm confident, but you know, you've got to look beyond your own local interests and really think about what's the fundamental issue. So for me, I'm very happy to meet with the Regional Education Commissioner. I'm very happy to talk about that issue and see whether there is common ground that we can play in to come up with a system that's going to be more sustainable for the long term.
Maybe we'll see more commonality between what's happened in the past in Canberra and what happens in the future in Mount Isa after all, eh?
You never know. You never know.
Well, thanks for sharing those thoughts with us on the HeadEx podcast today, Simon.
Always no worries, Martin. Pleasure.
So, Theo Farrell, the new, I think I'd still describe you as new Vice Chancellor of La Trobe University. Lovely to see you here at the UA conference.
Real pleasure, Martin. Yeah, real pleasure.
And look, Theo, here we are with, couldn't be a better time to be a new Vice Chancellor, could there, with a brand new Universities Accord final report setting such an ambitious agenda for the sector for the next 25 years. I don't know if you'll still be Vice Chancellor of La Trobe University in 25 years' time, but at this point in time, what are your thoughts about the highlights of the report and anything that in any way disappoints you of what we've read and learned?
Look, I'm really delighted by the vision and the ambition in this report. It just doesn't disappoint in that sense. It's what you would hope to come from this process, and it's the kind of report in terms of its ambition that you would hope Minister Clare would then take on and take forward. It's a whole set of challenges about how it would be funded, of course, but broadly speaking, the focus on students, the student-centred approach, the proposed proposed move to a planned needs-based funding model, the support for students on placements to reduce placement poverty, these are all incredibly welcome. So, you know, as the Vice Chancellor of a university that's deeply committed to equity and widening participation, you know, myself and our university greatly welcome this report.
I can remember you joining us, thanks for that, I can remember you joining us on stage in Sydney in July last year, the day after the interim report. You were at a different university at the time. But one of the very short acronyms that you noted was perhaps missing from the interim report. I'll be interested in what you think about its place in the final report and our thinking right now going forward. AI. It was the talk of the whole conference and of the whole sector last July. I'm sure it's even more important to us now, isn't it? What do you think about the place that we're seeing technological innovation for the sector in this vision for the next 25 years? And what more do we need to focus on if it's not already spelled out?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really fair point, and AI gets a bare mention in this report. And I think in the years to come, it will increasingly be an issue of attention for universities, because AI potentially is the thing that will unlock productivity in our economy. So the report is focused on skills and developing skills and future workforce Australia needs to have a prosperous economy. But in many ways, AI is going to be the thing that unlocks growth in what is now a service-based economy. So I think as universities, we're going to have to increasingly think about how we integrate AI in everything we do, in our research and our operations, but most importantly, in how we prepare our graduates for a future that will be reshaped by AI.
Well, for someone, I don't know how many weeks you are into the new role yet, must be still a handful of weeks, I assume. That must be one of a huge number of issues with this new accord that you're trying to grapple with. What is your sense, what is the sense that you can share with us of the priorities for an Australian Vice Chancellor, newly with the opportunity of being fresh in role over the next 3, 6 and 12 months in front of us?
Look, I think this final report now of the Australian Universities Accord will become a priority for, I think, all Vice Chancellors as we engage with government in taking forward the recommendations. But more immediately, there's a set of priorities around how we deal with the migration strategy, and the implementation is creating a few issues, I think, for universities now. So I think we have a bit of work to do around how we adapt, because we obviously want to give as much opportunity for genuine students to come here, international students to study with us. So I think we've got quite a bit of work to do with government and some key issues. But overall, it's a good time. It's lots of optimistic recommendations there and things that we can work with.
Probably a good idea to have a professor of war strategy running one of our universities at a time like this, if I've got that title still in any way right.
Martin, I wouldn't have any idea of whom you're referring to there.
I think we all know exactly who we're talking about, Theo, and we know that you're incredibly well equipped for the challenges ahead, and I thank you personally for all the support you've given to HEDX over the years and for your engagement in the priorities right now and in the coming months.
Thanks, Martin. Really, really important kind of discussion we're having.
Alex Zielinski, Vice Chancellor of University of Newcastle. Lovely to see you at the UA conference.
And good morning to you, Martin. Great to see you again.
It is a very important time to be talking, isn't it? At the launch of the university's accord, so fresh in all of our consciousness and minds.
Yes.
I'm sure you've got lots of views about the accord and what it means for the sector.
Yeah.
And maybe you want to share with us some of your highlights of what you're most pleased to see in the accord's final report.
Well, firstly, I'd just like to congratulate Mary O'Kane and the accord panel on the accord. It's a big piece of work. It is visionary with big ideas that will actually set Australia up for this century in higher education and tertiary education in general.
So it's going to set us up. I guess there's a lot of devil in the detail of implementation and how much of it gets funded and implemented. But with that in mind, what's your biggest concern and fear about all of the possibilities that might not get realised with this piece of...
I think with us as a sector, we've got to get behind the reforms here. And I think cherry picking only invites cherry picking by government. And I really do see this as very much an omnibus. Maybe it can't all be implemented tomorrow, maybe summer's next year, the year after, but we really need to get behind the vision. All those ideas, either be around equity, were fantastic, research, wonderful, about ideas of having needs-based funding. These are all wonderful initiatives, and thinking how we can work more seamlessly with the vocational sector and TAFE is very useful. And when I look at the report, I can't say I disagree with it. I mean, there's some things you might want to tweak or something, but I think that it's more about the implementation, Martin. And the key here is really for the sector to get behind their accord. Because remember, they did consult extensively. They consulted extensively, and this is the result of an extensive consultation, and it may not suit every institution.
I think you're absolutely right, and it would seem a bit churlish to, just because not each of us get everything that we would each want, we might then stand in the way of what the sector needs.
Exactly.
I imagine for Newcastle, Alex, that there you are as one of the greatest examples of a regional university, with, I know from the messages you put out, but I know it myself, we all know it in Australia, that Newcastle is in the heart of one of the greatest areas of equity need and transformation need in the country.
Absolutely.
Given that you're going to play fair with the whole sector and toe the party line and let go of your own ego of anything that you wish was there, but sign up to the vision, what specifically at Newcastle are you now going to be doing over the next 3, 6, 12 months to enact the opportunity that the Accord gives to your university?
Certainly we see the equity element to this program is very good. And we are a university that celebrates equity, and we walk the talk. We've got the most Indigenous students in the country. We've got the highest number of low SES elements students. Those targets that were set in the Accord, we're actually achieving them already. So we are on that mission. What we now need to do is to expand the participation rate. So we're at 25%. Participation rate in higher education. As we move into renewable and clean energy and get off the fossil fuels, there'll be a need to retrain the workforce and to get into the new industry. So that's why it's important. And those people don't necessarily have the background to go straight into university. So that's why these enabling programs are so, so important to be able to transition, as well as doing the research, which is based around these sort of challenges. And I've got to say that one of the things I was really, there's some surprising things in the Accord, like the grand challenges. This is mission-driven research. This is a wonderful thing, because here in the Hunter, we need to have mission-driven research around, say, the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy. And that's the kind of thing that I see. There's so many possibilities in the Accord that we want to continue to work for and with. And by the way, as a university that is a leader in equity, we're very happy to help the sector, help the minister, to show how we've done this and to roll it out extensively across Australia.
Well, it's great to have you on the HeadX podcast in this special from UA today to show leadership in that way. Alex, I'm delighted. Sorry that you can't be with us in Melbourne on March the 21st, but I'm loving it that you're sending Kent on behalf of the university. Yes. He's got so much wisdom in this space from both sides of the fence, hasn't he?
He has. Kent's very experienced, and my apologies for not being able to join your wonderful events. I always enjoy them, Martin. They're very entertaining, informative and incisive.
Well, they become informative and incisive by the guests that we have. Like, we had you on the stage in July last year at Sydney. We look forward to Kent being with us this month or next month in Melbourne, and maybe we'll have you later in the year when we
absolutely
come to Brisbane.
Good on. Thanks,
all
mate.
The best. Thanks, Alex.
Cheers.
Nicola from OES. Nicola Cresp from OES. Thank you very much for joining us here at the UA conference. It's been great to hear Mary O'Kane talk about the Accord report released on Sunday, just in the session earlier this morning. What do you think of the university's Accord report? What are you seeing as the highlights, and what are you seeing as things that you'd most wished to have seen in there that weren't there?
absolutely terrific, like the response has been, and it was great to hear Mary talking about it this morning. For me, I have a particular interest in international students, and I was a little disappointed that that wasn't a focus, but Mary did respond to that in her question and answer session afterwards. I'd like to see a focus on fostering international students and quality international students and how we can respond to that, and I do like the emphasis on taking our Australian education to the international market. So that was a good feature for me.
Yeah, they were good features, weren't they? And look, there was a lot more mention in the final report than I think many of us had observed in the interim report around the place of technology and the place of online technologies in the delivery of education, particularly in that space of rural and regional students in Australia and in international students.
Yeah.
What did you make of that as an individual observer, and what does OES make of that?
Yeah, OES has been very strong in delivering on the equity numbers for our partner universities, so that it is great for us. The emphasis on that, the additional funding for that, and that's something that we know we can deliver on the rural, remote, also first in family. Also, there was the piece in the accord about allowing students to work while they're studying. So undergrad students to be able to do that part-time, and that is something that is our bread and butter. So that was really pleasing to hear that acknowledged.
Bread and butter indeed, and going from strength to strength as a company with new deals that you're signing up here and around the world. Thanks very much for joining us in this conversation today, Nicola.
Thanks, Martin.
Great to see you here at the UA conference, Ben Hallett at Vigo. How have you been this last little while?
Mate, a lot of reading the last couple of nights, but really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed the final accord so far, and some really interesting tidbits in it, and as David Lloyd was saying, some spicy elements.
What was spiciest for you? And what was sweetest for you and what you read in 408 pages in 2 days?
Well, Vigo, we're a mission-led business, and I care so much about student experience and making sure that every year the sector gets better at preventing students from falling through the cracks. And, that is just one consistent theme throughout the entire accord. And so I really enjoyed seeing that. But in particular, the part that really stood out most interesting for me is the student ombudsman. That seems to be the, now that the SFS has been pushed through and turned into law, that seems to be the next thing that's coming up quite quickly. And I guess what the accord pointed out to me is that the scope of the ombudsman is much bigger than the gender-based violence that it's been more talked about in the last couple of months. And it's going to include a lot of different things, and including student support world. So that was a big interesting part for me.
So interesting in both a spicy and a sweet way. It's addressing a really spicy problem, but got some good solutions for it, you think, in how students can get a better experience out of the end of all this. Nice to hear you have a focus. Mm-hmm. Nice and not surprising to hear you have a focus on that, Ben.
It's what we're passionate about. So, it's why we do it. And the Ombudsman is not something the sector has seen for students, and if it looks like some of the other sectors, it could become a quite powerful tool. And particularly, I'm wondering, is this going to be the vehicle for those $18,000 SFS fines the government was talking about?
Well, I'm sure everyone's trying to do their best in a real scramble to avoid those fines. Yeah. I know that when we spoke on webinars and podcasts last year and at our conference as long ago as last July, we had a strong focus on supporting the sector in getting policies together and some thoughts together around that. We've got your colleague, your co-CEO, Joel De Trapani, joining us at our conference in Melbourne in March.
Yep.
I dare say he's going to have another side to that story and a complimentary picture of some solutions learned from global experiences that he has based in the US and the UK markets around other people's approaches to some of these things. Is that a fair summary of what Vigo will bring to our conference?
Yeah, Joel, co-CEO, arguably the more attractive one of us. But
you said that, not me.
but he spent the last year living over in Texas and working a lot and understanding with the institutions nearby, and there's a lot of things that are different about Australia and in the US, but there's a lot of interesting ideas that can be rethought of in an Australian context as well.
Well, look, we really look forward to hearing from Joel in front of
you know, a room full of sector leaders there from the room full of sector leaders that we've been with here, Ben. And thank you very much for all of your support of what we're doing in HeadX and the great work that you're doing in Vigo looking after the sector students.
Appreciate that, mate. Good luck at the conference.
Now I'm joined by Andrew Norton, policy analyst at the Australian National University. Nice to see you at the UA conference, Andrew. How are you?
Good, thanks, Matt.
And Andrew, I've enjoyed chatting to you at this venue over a number of years and on the HeadX activities over a couple of years now around emerging policy. Here we are at what must be a bit of a watershed time for the sector in terms of new policy. I'm sure you have lots of views about the university as a whole, but if I was to ask you, like I've asked many others, what the highlights are for you of the thing that you think is most valuable in this course, what would it be?
Well, I actually think probably the practical recommendations around improving the experience for students at university, you know, potential extra funding for needs-based teaching, teacher training perhaps for some academics, and I think there's some good material on revising how we charge students, the student contributions, and then how they repay, with a lot of important detail to come though.
Important detail indeed, and that might be a bit of a segue to what I can imagine you might have something to say about, in that you're a great one for finding the eyes, picking the eyes out of and finding, you know, the real detailed issues that we really need to attend to in all aspects of policy development in this sector. What most troubles you about the report at the moment and causes you to have concern about how much we know and don't know and where we're going?
So even though I'm less concerned about the Tertiary Education Commission idea than I was last year after the interim report, I still think we have potential difficulties with the potentially extreme power that this commission might have, what that means for university autonomy in the future, and the practical consequences if the commission becomes dysfunctional, as some government commissions have in the past, and we're reliant on it to make decisions. So I think that's going to be one of the most important design features of this, to design it in a way that it's robust to things going wrong, and the sector can actually make a lot of decisions itself.
Maybe we should make Andrew Norton the new Tertiary Education Commission Commissioner.
Well, I don't believe in regulating this way, so I'm not suitable.
Sorry, that was a light-hearted... But if you're not going to be doing that role then, what's going to be your focus in all of the great work you do into our sector in the ongoing detailing and consideration of this bit of policy change?
Look, my main area is the domestic student funding system. And so I'll take a lot of interest in how they set funding rates. And of course, into this constantly vexed question of how students are charged and how they repay. And so because this is now something that affects millions of Australians, it's actually got quite broad policy and political consequences. This is not a niche sector anymore, particularly if you count vocational education. Even discounting the more extreme attainment targets, we're still going to have 60-70% of the population interacting with these systems over their lives.
Yes, and I've seen some of the things you've written in the last couple of days about it, and I agree with almost all of it. Not only is it higher attainment targets in terms of what we can supply and fund, but it's a very high target in terms of what people want and are prepared to pay for. Do you want to elaborate any more on whether we've had enough attention on what the demand for tertiary education is?
I think one of the conceptual problems with the report is, even though it says it's student-centred, in a couple of important areas, it's not. So the overall 55% higher education attainment is basically an employer perspective. These are the skills we need, you must apply these skills, rather than what students might actually want to do with their lives. And then again, with the equity targets, there's no reflection on whether higher education actually is in the best interest of these people who need to go to higher education to meet these targets. So in my view, this is a top-down view of how society should look, rather than something that's practically orientated to making people's lives better than they would be otherwise.
Sounds a bit un-Australian, doesn't it?
Well, I've got good intentions, but we, as Australians, we should be very pragmatic and really ask, you know, how do these sums add up and do they make sense for the students involved?
Well, thanks very much for sharing those views and very considered for a long period of rigorous policy analysis. Thoughts about the Accord and the future of higher education, Andrew.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, I'm joined now by Nadine Zacharias, a good friend of HeadX from podcasts and webinars last year from an organisation called Equity by Design. How are you, Nadine?
Yeah, very well, Martin. Thank you.
Great to talk. Sorry.
No, it's so great to be in Canberra with, you know, all the people you see once a year. To talk about the Accord.
It is, and talking about the Accord is the subject of the day, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Look, I'm fascinated by what you think with all of the focus you've had on student equity and on the appropriate support for students, the reactions to the students for support or support for students policy that we discussed at the time that it was in formation. Yeah. Now the dust has settled. What did you think that the Accord has got to say about student support and student equity, and what pleases you most?
Yeah, look, equity is obviously central in the Accord. You know, like Mary O'Kane said it on the stage this morning, it's skills through equity, so it couldn't be more central. The idea of needs-based funding is how, you know, the Accord approaches the need for additional support. I think this is a tricky assumption that we really need to interrogate. You know, like that all students who come from the targeted cohorts need the same support. I think that is highly unlikely, so we really need to unpick, you know, like the supports across the four targeted groups and what will be required, and also how we get coordination between the different universities on how they will approach the task of supporting these target cohorts really well. So we're taking a bit of the guardrails off by the looks of it, and so there's a bit to unpack in there in how we guide the actions across the sector around needs-based funding and targeting these services at different student groups.
I sensed it when we met on that webinar, and I can feel it in the tone of your voice now. For people like you that have been so involved in student equity for so long, this must be like the golden age, isn't it?
Well, it could be, but I'm not super convinced that it actually is. So I think at this point we are going from MATS to universal higher education, because more than 50% of the population are meant to engage in higher education. And I think that implies some significant shifts that we haven't fully thought through yet. And I think where some of the pushback is coming. So we really need to interrogate some of the taken for granted assumptions, address some of the holy cows of higher education. And in the last panel, we talked about products. So I think the products of higher education are really central in what we're doing. So I think what the focus on equity does, it gives us license to ask some fundamental questions of how we do higher education. And I think that's going to be the most exciting bit about it.
Fundamental questions indeed, and I'm sure you're going to keep asking them. I look forward to keep asking them and getting other people to answer them together. And thanks very much for joining us at UA today, Nadine.
No worries. Thanks for having me as part of the conversation.
Hello there, John. It's John Dewar, the former Vice-Chancellor of La Trobe University and Chair of UA, now in some exciting new roles here in the foyer of the UA conference. How's it going, John?
Great conference so far.
Great conference so far, and great debate that you've been in a number of positions leading into, going through, and now coming out of the outside of. With the positions you now hold, what are your thoughts about the Accord in terms of what were the highlights for you of what we've seen so far up to today? And what are the things, if any, that disappoint you in any way about where we've got to?
I think the highlight is that, as Mary O'Kane said this morning, it's a very joined up series of propositions about the future of higher education. I'm particularly excited about the recognition that the one-size-fits-all model of funding that we have at the moment doesn't particularly serve the equity agenda that all of the sector is interested in pursuing. So some really good, creative, imaginative solutions to addressing the equity challenge. And it really all flows from that incredibly ambitious participation target that in a sense is the fulcrum or the engine of the whole report, because if we're not able to attract more diverse communities into higher education, there's no way we're going to achieve those targets. And if we don't achieve those targets, then the nation's economy is going to be in serious trouble in 10 or 20 years time. So for me, it's got a strong sense of urgency about it. There's an economic imperative, there's a social cohesion imperative, and all of the proposals really align very nicely with that. I guess the thing that remains to be seen is firstly the government's willingness to fund all of this. Obviously, it is a very long wish list, and to some extent the government's going to handball that to its successors. And that's one reason why I think the Tertiary Education Commission is so important, because that's a way of ensuring that the legacy, as Mary O'Kane described it today, of this report does not get lost in the kind of the shifting sands of politics and successive elections. David Lloyd said there are going to be 8 elections between now and 2050. How do we ensure the longevity of these proposals? Well, the Tertiary Education Commission has to be a part of that. There's two other thoughts I've got on this. One is some universities are struggling a bit financially at the moment. There are ups and downs. There have been lots of ups and downs, particularly since COVID, in domestic and international student enrollments. Some universities are doing fine, others are not. But universities that were looking to the Accord for a kind of immediate source of financial relief, I think, are going to be disappointed, partly because governments have other priorities. Even within the education portfolio, they have other priorities. Partly because a lot of the changes that might benefit universities will have to await the creation of the Tertiary Education Commission, and that's not going to happen quickly. And the other is that a lot of the funding changes really focus on fairness to students rather than putting more unit of resource into institutions. So I think that there are vice chancellors or chancellors who are hoping for a financial boon from this, I think, might be disappointed. The final thing I'll say, Martin, this is a very long answer to your question, is that the creation of the commission and its mandate to drive greater diversity in the system and this emphasis on cross-tertiary collaboration, I think, is really exciting. Yeah. I think it creates many more strategic choices for universities than have been open to them in the past. If you think about it, the last 30 years, universities have been cookie cutter institutions in lots of ways. We've all been funded to do the same things. All the incentives for every institution have been the same. What this opens up is a real possibility of diversity, of strategic choice, of differentiation. And for me, that's one of the most exciting things.
What a lovely note to finish on, John. Thanks for joining us.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for joining us the day after the launch of the Universities Accord, just before you're going on for a lovely workshop of Universities Enable around the great work that you're doing in leading on disability. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, Martin, for the opportunity to present.
And, Paul, we all had our weekends interrupted. We're meant to be having weekends off, and instead we all read the Accord. What did you like most about what you read yesterday?
Well, I like the fact that we've got a real thought leadership, and we're continuing that thought leadership, like the Tertiary Education Commission. I thought how even though we've got a lot of practical outcomes and operational outcomes, we've continued to create frameworks for future thinking in the sector, particularly the research on the sector, I think is really important, because otherwise we're going to get in a situation where in 2024 we do some great, well, in 2023 and 2024 we've got some great thinking, 25 we start implementing, but then 26, 27 we might stop that process of continual improvement, and in business we keep improving and innovating. And so I think some of those research frameworks around researching on universities will enable us to be innovative into the future.
I picked up on some of those ideas too, and you and I have talked about that in the past, and the idea that that might then go into the sector developing new and different sorts of universities and more differentiation through the oversight of the commission. Is that something that's stuck in your mind as well?
Yeah, I think that idea of the commission will help lead it, but I think also getting it back into the university research framework itself and how they're going to help with government as well, that was another really strong thing I felt really was positive. Because one of the things a lot of universities are struggling to is build our consultancy with government. I think, and really commitment from government to say, hey, we want to use the brilliance we've got in our university sector, will make it easier for universities to replace some of the for-profit PwCs and Ernst & Youngs, who are great, no doubt. But if you're going to be giving public money to someone, wouldn't it be good if the money went to a university who can then use the profits from that to educate the leaders of tomorrow.
I think that sounds like a great idea, Paul. And so, look, lots to like about the 407, 408. I've better go back and start counting again. But what was missing from it with all of that volume that you'd most hoped to see? And you think, from where you sit in the community and where you sit in the sector, could have most helped us move forward?
For me, the standout issue, when I read it, I went, are they serious? Which, I mean, I loved a lot of it, but it was when you talked about disability, students with disability, the idea was to maintain. And in that section, there's other groups that have figures for gender improvement, Indigenous improvement, and for disabilities had maintained. So I think that needs to be addressed, I think, when we move forward into implementation and say, look, even if you're just going to want to maintain, you need a figure. You need to know, it's not, and it's also the idea of maintaining and seems to suggest that what we've got now is good enough. When you read it in context, I think what it's saying is the current trajectory of improving. So we, you know, 10 years ago, it was 4% of our student population up to 8%. And then with the COVID, it caused a spike. And now we're about 9% overall of our student population with a disability. And UQ's got over 10% and some of the GO8 as well into 12%. So we're continually to improve, but I think the word maintain really indicates what we've got is good enough, and that might cause a lack of attention. I think we need a figure, and we need to keep improving and keep addressing why aren't we improving if we're not.
Sounds like you're going to keep the rage going and keep the debate going. And look, you and I will next be together on stage in Melbourne on March the 21st when you're leading a great looking panel talking about equity across all of its dimensions in the sector. Tell us a little bit about what that panel is going to be about and how you're going to be able to bring that thought that you just had of what's missing from the Accord into the ongoing debate with colleagues.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'm going to do is read the book I'm holding, which you kindly autographed, which you've produced. In fact, you want to read the name out?
Yeah, the book's called Changing Higher Education for Good. It's come out today. It's come out the day after the Accord. It's been written over the last 12 months or so by 50 interviews with brilliant people, including people like you.
And so I think what we'll be looking at is really thought leadership, because I think this sector, we need it, and it's 21 March is really close to this groundbreaking accord coming out. We're still going to be digesting, and it was, I think my word count said over 130,000 words. And at the same space that for a lot of these, there's a lot of other big reports out that are impacting on this. So in disability space alone, you've got the Disability Royal Commission, which is about 2.5 million words. 12 volumes, you know, and then you've got the NDIS review just out, which impacts upon students and staff with disabilities. There's so many reports, so much happening in the sector, and if we can bring it all together, the best of it, and really start to focus on the future, I think our sector, which is already world leading, will go even further and become the world leader.
Well, there's no shortage of words that we've all got to play with, is there? There's perhaps a greater need for some action. And I know you're very action-oriented in everything you do. You lead by example. You're someone with lived experience that is easy to follow by many others that either have those experiences or need to appreciate them. And you're about to lead a workshop for us here at the UA conference as a satellite event on behalf of Universities Enabled. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what, by the time this comes out, that event will have been about?
Yeah, the Disability Royal Commission and what it means for higher education, some of the implications. So you'll see you've got the social model into the DRC. So a lot of university policies, for example, talk about disability through a medical model lens, just focusing on disability as in a medical problem, which is what they do in the Disability Discrimination Act, which is, was drafted in 1990. So it's somewhat out of date. So the UN's Convention of Rights of Persons with Disabilities adopts this social model at disability interacts with society, and so does the DRC. And so that's a very simple and workable outcome for universities is to go, does our policies reflect a new model? And the new model, which is now really truly ingrained. And we've got a number of other workable solutions, including how to empower your staff and students with disabilities to help universities come up with workable solutions. Because after all, they have the expertise that we need to, in many cases, to drive the reforms, which can increase access, reduce costs, and lead to a sector which is more inclusive for everyone.
Well, there you go, Ant. That right. Was a comprehensive set of views back from Vice Chancellors about what they think of the University's Accord final report. What are your reflections just in closing this episode then about what the mood is in the sector as an outcome? Not what you think, but what you feel the mood is of the sector at this point in time.
I think there's a real buzz here in Canberra. It's always a buzz at Universities of Australia, but particularly this year, because there is so much to chew over and discuss. And I think, you know, when people are reflective, what they're saying is the purpose and the role of the sector in national life has been well celebrated and articulated. And nothing explains that more than the projected growth in participation. You know, ultimately, why people are getting up every day, running their university or playing other roles supporting the sector is really, you know, we want more people to be educated and to receive the benefits of a tertiary education. And really that's the thread that I think has run throughout the event. Of course, people want to pick on particular policy issues and everyone's got their little angle and so on. And, you know, inevitably people are going to find disappointment. But I would say overall, people are really, really pleased with the narrative, the tone, and the direction of travel for the sector.
So if I was to put you on the spot then and say 2 scores out of 10, what does Ant Bagshaw give this report out of 10? And what do you believe the sector has given this report out of 10?
That's a great question, Martin. I think for me, I see bits that are a 10, I see bits that are a 4. So maybe I'm coming with an average of 7, and that's where I'll sit. I think the sector's coming at it slightly differently. I think there is a lot in the short term to be pleased about, and I think the sector will be looking about 8 out of 10. And then there's a question mark over the long term, you know, whether that score goes up, and really that's about resourcing, or whether that score heads in the other direction if some of the promises don't come to fruition.
Well, that's very interesting. 7 out of 10 for you and maybe out of 10 for the sector. When you're on stage leading a panel of vice chancellors and DVCs in Melbourne on March the 21st, and you've just interviewed them all and they've had 3 weeks to think about it, I might come back to you with that question as we close the panel and see if your sense is whether the meters have gone up or down over 3 weeks.
Deal. I'll take it.
And that's all we've got time for this week on Headings.
Thanks, Martin.